My name is Katie. I'm an alcoholic. Really grateful to be here tonight. Thank you, Sam, so much for asking me and for all of you for having me. I was commenting. I enjoyed a really nice, even though it was raining, very beautiful drive up here from Richmond today. And I'm just really grateful to be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. To me, it's an honor and a privilege to be asked to do anything in AA. Because before I got sober, there weren't a lot of people who wanted much from me anymore other than to like maybe go, don't come back, leave my things on the way out. You know, like I burned a lot of goodwill before I got here. And so whatever I can do to give back, I'm grateful to do. Although I'll say at the outset, this is not the best service for me. Like the best service for me is like if you need some cups washed after the meeting, like that's really where I get my serenity. I'm somebody that likes being the center of attention, so this is not the best thing for me to be doing, but I'm grateful to be here. And I love what you read at the beginning, because I actually go in the bathroom and read that every time before I speak. I started with that part of how it works. We share in a general way what it used to be like, what happened, and what we're like now. And then finding that a few years back, I really do think that's my purpose whenever I talk, is to share about the way that I established a relationship with a higher power, because for me, that's the thing. That's the thing that got me sober, that keeps me sober. It's the difference between what my life was like on April 13th, 2003, and what it's been since April 14th, 2003. That is my sobriety date. I have a home group. It's the Easy Does It Women's Meeting on Monday nights. We meet at 8 o'clock. I still haven't gotten the name of the church right, but it's on Monument Avenue in Richmond. And if you're a woman and you're looking for a meeting, we'd love to have you. It's open discussion. And I have a sponsor. I talked to her on the way here, and I sponsor other women. And I'm the business meeting chair of my home group, so I'm active in service and Alcoholics Anonymous. And I share all that not because I'm the perfect AA, which I thought that's what that was all for when I got here, right, is that I'm going to be the perfect AA and check all the boxes. But because I have found that I have to do all those things, I have to live in the circle and the triangle if I want to have my daily reprieve. You know, I have to be active in working and living these steps and passing it on to other people and in being a present and active member of Alcoholics Anonymous and the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous and the meetings and you know, the things that we do with each other outside of meetings. And when I do those things, I have a pretty great life today, you know? Like, my skin fits, I can look the world in the eye, I generally feel at peace and ease. I don't hate myself and everyone else around me, you know? I'm not contemplating murder and suicide at any given point in the day. Like, I just am, and that's awesome. Like, I used to think that what I wanted was those really, really high highs, but I'm really good, like, in the middle now. And that's what I get from doing that, all of that. And I don't know which part of it is the thing that's going to make the difference on any given day. When I was drinking, I found that I didn't get to pick my consequences. And for me, like, the spiritual life is like, I don't get to pick where my reprieve comes from. I don't get to pick where the next level of growth or the next, you know, piece of awareness is going to come from. So I just got to keep showing up so that I keep that channel open. And I was telling a few people before the meeting, I'm not from Virginia originally. I grew up outside of Seattle, Washington. I did all my drinking out there. I got sober out there. I only came to Virginia as a result of sobriety and the gifts that we get given. I came out here to go to law school in 2009, and I haven't left, except for like a brief year in DC, but it's not really that far. I knew about alcoholism before I ever took a drink. My mom is a member of this program. She got sober when I was 16 years old and diagnosed her own alcoholism. So I'm pretty comfortable sharing from the podium that she's an alcoholic. And if even she didn't think she was an alcoholic, there was a lot of alcoholic stuff that went on in our life, you know? And the flip side of that is that my dad used to sell alcohol for a living. And so, like, we had one big happy family centered around alcohol my whole life. I was an only child until I was 6, which is where I think I get that like limelight seeker from, because I just, you know, basked in that. And you know, I know that I never really felt like other people looked. Like, even with that, I just, I remember before things started happening, and the long story short is that a lot of stuff happened before I hit that first drink that made alcohol a really attractive solution to me. But even before all that, like, I just never felt like quite right. Like, I had to do just a little bit more. I had to be just a little bit louder. I had to get just a little bit more attention to feel like maybe on par with you. And I, you know, it's just always felt like I missed the day in kindergarten where they handed out the instructions for life. And I felt that way before stuff started happening. And then as stuff started happening, I felt more and more estranged from the world and the people around me. And I had grown up, you know, we were like Christmas and Easter Catholics. So like I knew enough to feel guilty and that was about it. But I remember like trying to work on that relationship with a higher power at like 5, 6 years old. And I would say my prayers every night before I went to bed. And what I could come up with was a list of the people that I loved and then a list of all the most horrible things that could happen to a person. And then I would every night ask God not to let those things happen to those people. And I would go to bed terrified that if I forgot a person or a thing, that that thing would happen to that person and it would be my fault. Which is way too much power for a 6-year-old. And it also, I think, is it's my default setting when it comes to God, that I tell you what I want and then you're Santa Claus and you just make it happen, you know? Like, and I can do that even in sobriety. It doesn't look like the two lists now, but my default relationship with a power greater than myself is to you give me what I want on my terms or you're not there. You know, and it just wasn't a sustainable relationship, because then when things started happening, I mean, things started happening that I didn't even know should be on the lists as a kid. I just didn't feel like there was anything there that had my back, you know? My brother was born when I was 6. He has a rare genetic disease that took 8 years to diagnose, so there was a lot of, like, fear and anxiety. There were a lot of misdiagnoses. A lot of, is he going to live past 1? Is he going to live past 2? You know, just a lot of heartache and a lot of fear. And so, you know, for me, I started to see the cracks in my family, which I, you know, hadn't really appreciated until then. Because even though I come from an alcoholic home, I also come from a very loving home, which I didn't know until I was like 4 or 5 years sober. I would tell you how bad it was, and then we'd talk about my drinking and be done. You know, but I did. I had a lot of opportunities. I got to be involved in a lot of things. I had parents who drove minivans to soccer fields at 8 a.m. on a Saturday morning in the rain. Like, if that's not what love, I don't know what is, you know? But the thing that matters to me is that I couldn't feel any of that. You know, like, that kind of stuff was going on around me, and I didn't feel loved. Whatever you do outside of me to try and make me feel good and happy, like, even before I found alcohol, wasn't enough. It just wasn't enough. I couldn't, you know, there was always something in between me and you. And, you know, my family was the type of alcoholic family that as long as there was a white picket fence and 2 cars in the garage and a dog and a cat and everybody had a job, we were good. And don't look behind the veneer. And so if the doors were closed, the windows were closed, like, it didn't matter what went on in the house or how chaotic it was, as long as no one outside knew about it. And, you know, that I kind of bought into that, and I did a lot of my own drinking that way, where I built up the kind of what I viewed as like the first line of defense, the picture that I want the world to see. And, you know, that was what I used to keep people from learning the truth about me and my alcoholism for a long time. When I was my brother was born, and there was all that going on. So there's a lot of chaos. There's a lot of fear. And then when I was 10, I was molested over a period of months at school by a teacher. Used to just say I was the victim of a crime, but, it, you know, because I'm not comfortable talking about that still. But it happened. And the thing that mattered to me about that was that after that happened, it did come out. I talked to my parents. I talked to the principal at the school. And nobody really did anything. You know, it was like I got moved to a different classroom and that was it. And what I learned from that was that nobody was going to take care of me ever. You know, and that to me was the experience that if there is a God out there, he's not looking after me and I'm just going to have to start taking care of myself. And so at 10, you know, whatever faith I had in people, in a higher power, it was just gone. And then I think like the next year, my mom got a DUI and started coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, like her first time I was aware of. And she would take me to meetings with her. And I don't know if it was the proximity of those events that in my mind, all of a sudden I had an answer for everything that had gone wrong. And the answer was that my mom was an alcoholic. And that thing made us different because I assumed that everybody lived the way that we did in chaos. But then when I went over, they could play nice because I was there. I was a stranger. You know, I'm from the outside. We don't show people. And I started to realize that maybe that wasn't true. And I got really angry and I got really resentful. And at 11 years old, I swore to myself, I'm never going to be an alcoholic. You know, I'm never going to do this. I'm never going to hurt the people that I love the way that I felt I had been hurt at the time. And that resolve and that decision worked really well for me for 2 years until I found alcohol. You know, I started drinking at 13. I had had alcohol before that. You know, my dad sold it for a living. You know, I remember going on vacation at 12 and having him teach me how to drink wine the right way, because that was an important vacation event for a 12-year-old. But I don't count any of that. You know, I don't know when the first time I actually had alcohol was, but I know the first time that I drank, you know, where I got my hands on some alcohol and I drank enough to find out what alcohol could do for me, that, you know, the effect produced by alcohol. I discovered that when I was 13 years old. And, you know, I was going through one of those transitions where you move from one school to another and you're top of the heap down to the bottom. And I don't like change. I don't like change. It makes me uncomfortable. I don't know how to deal with it. I took one look at the, you know, the kids who lived in the nicer neighborhood with more cars in the garage than we had. And I'm like, I can't keep up with them. And so I immediately find the kids with the purple hair and the spiky belts and the combat boots. And I'm like, my people, you know, because I can't stand to be in the middle. And, you know, those people had found alcohol and other things that produced the same effect. And, you know, I wanted to be like them and I wanted to be accepted by them. And so I started down that path. And for me, the effect produced by alcohol was relief. You know, I just finally felt like I could breathe. Whatever was between me and you was gone. Like I was able to just feel a part of life without that asterisk, you know, like whatever missing piece I did not have when I came off the assembly line, like alcohol was like that replacement part from the factory that just made everything work right. And so I had this dilemma at 13 years old. I really like the effect produced by alcohol, but I have promised myself that I would not become an alcoholic. And that was really important to me. And I should mention, before I started drinking, my first solution was to get a boyfriend. And then when that didn't work, I started drinking. And that's pretty much, if you just hit repeat on that with increasing consequences, was my drinking. Get a boy. When the boy doesn't work, get drunk. Repeat, 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 repeat. And, you know, so I, from almost the very beginning of my drinking, set out to control alcohol. You know, I'm going to control it because I developed this theory that I could not become an alcoholic if I didn't drink. But if I could find other things that produce the same effect in me, those were fair game and, like, you know, nothing to worry about. And so I set about to find things that would change the way that I felt from the inside out. You know, I like light switch happy. You just flip a switch and it's better. You know, I don't like patience. I don't like persistence. I don't like any of those things that's like you got to wait around a while for things to get better. Not my bag, you know. And so I spent a lot of time out there avoiding alcohol on the theory that if I didn't drink, I wouldn't become an alcoholic. And, you know, I really do believe in our singleness of purpose, Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, when I got sober, finally, I went to every fellowship that ended in Anonymous because I had all the problems that came before it. And I did that for a few months. And, you know, I have a lot of respect for the other fellowships. And I think that they have access to the same solution that we do. For me, I heard the music in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I know that that was a power greater than myself doing for me what I can't do for myself, because I have never once since I've gotten sober thought of using cocaine socially. Not crossed my mind. I've never struggled with the idea that I'm powerless over those things. But I cannot tell you how many times, I mean, I was over a year sober before I let go of the idea that I would not be able to drink wine with dinner when I was 35, like my father, you know, who's not an alcoholic. And when I went to college, watching people around me discover alcohol for the first time and being in the beginning of that relationship and, you know, the magic, because I drank for a couple of years without consequence and it was awesome. You know, I felt great. I had friends, people were around, things were happening. I didn't care that, you know, my mom was awful and we didn't get along and the house was violent and all that. Like, I just didn't, none of that stuff mattered because I had an out, you know, and seeing other people discover that after I had gotten sober, you know, the magic and the romanticism of like, well, maybe, you know, alcohol really wasn't the problem, you know, and I can fall prey to that kind of thinking. And so I am so grateful that I am an Alcoholics Anonymous, because I come here and we talk about alcohol and I have to remember every day that I'm an alcoholic. Being a member of Alcoholics Anonymous keeps that so real for me. But I mean, I'm a garbage can. I don't care what it is. As long as you've got more of it or something else that we can like mix together and have a good time, like, I don't care. The only thing I cared about from the beginning was alcohol, because I did not want to be an alcoholic. And I developed that first line of defense, right? I decided pretty early on, I had just come like fresh off of the DARE program, and I knew that the kids who got let their grades slip or the kids who started getting in trouble, you know, they're the ones who were getting caught. And I'm like, okay, so don't let your grades slip. It became very important to me to have straight A's. That was something, it was like almost a compulsion in and of itself, that as long as I had those letters on a piece of paper, no one could tell me there was anything wrong with me. A couple of years in, I got a job so I could earn my own money, and I became a night manager at a Quiznos, and that was very important to me because I had a job, I had management responsibilities, and I had these letters on a piece of paper. And these were the things that, you know, no one will know what's wrong with me as long as I've got those pieces on the board. You know, no one's going to know. And that was like my first line of defense for anyone who wanted to talk about my drinking, because, you know, 14, 15 years old, people started to want to talk about my drinking, which I found confusing, because I, in my mind, was very successful. You know, I was checking the boxes that I had decided were important. And when I was 15 years old, that boyfriend, and my best friend came to me. They both worked at that Quiznos with me, and they told me that they were very worried about my drinking and the things that I was doing at that time. And the way that my drinking worked is I kind of had one thing that I was doing a lot of, and then I always had a line in the sand. I had something else that I wasn't doing that I'm like, well, I'm not that bad because, you know, I'm not doing this or I'm not doing that. And, you know, I was in that, and inevitably, whatever that line was, that was the next thing that I did. It wasn't like I worked my way over there eventually. I woke up on the other side of the line all the time, and I would immediately redraw it. Like, I'm the kind of alcoholic, like, I go down faster than I can lower my standards. But the thing, it's not really the speed. It's the fact that when I wake up on the other side of the line, I'm not mortified. I'm like, oh, I have no qualms changing like these firmly held beliefs that I, you know, had been like self-defining for a long period of time if I need to keep doing what I want to do, you know? And so I was actually nearing, although no one knew it yet, another line, but they had seen me do that a few times, and I had been, I think, on a, like a 9-month bender where I would wake myself up in the morning and then put myself to sleep at night. You know, and the thing that I had then was I was volunteering in the special needs classroom at my high school, and I was like, but I don't get messed up until I'm done working with the children, so I have it under control, you know? Like, I'm able to make it through first period, which is like 7 a.m., you know? And they asked me to stop. They're like, if you're going to continue to do this, we can't be a part of this. And at that point, I was more afraid of being alone than trying to stop because I didn't think I had a problem. I thought, you know, I was in that phase of I can stop whenever I want to. I just don't want to. Why would you? I really relate to that part in our literature where it's like, you know, we think young people probably could have stopped at some point, but like, who wants to stop while there's yet still time? I'm like, yeah, I get that. Why would I want to stop? But they gave me a reason because I didn't want to be alone. You know, one of my biggest fears comes up on every inventory, being alone. Do not want to be alone. Oh, God. And so I stopped. And to me, what's significant about that experience is the way that I was without alcohol, after I had found out what alcohol could do for me, it was just nothing was ever going to be enough again. You know, nothing was ever going to touch that place that alcohol could get to, you know, even sometimes just the thought of alcohol, you know, like later on, you know, after my mom got sober, it got really hard for me to keep drinking. I did a lot of my drinking at night. And I'd have to get out of the house, and she wasn't sleeping because she had stopped drinking at 48 after years and years and years of putting herself to sleep with a fifth of vodka every night, you know? And I would like stand on the wall and listen to her breathing for hours and just like wait till I could get out and get a drink. And I would feel better standing there than in my room, you know, because the drink would be within reach, you know? And nothing else could come close to that after I found out what alcohol could do for me. And so at the end of about, I think it was a 3-month period, those same people who had asked me to stop came back to me and said, we think that you need to start drinking again. And if you just tell us about it, we'll help you control it. You know, because when I don't have relief, I'm really nasty. I was in a meeting yesterday. I was talking about this. Like, I like being mean to people. Like, it, you know, that ego and that selfishness and that self-centeredness, like, whatever I need to do to feel superior, and if it's, like, cutting you down to the quick with my words, like, I'll do it just to get, like, a little bit of that, like, self-satisfaction. Because that's, you know, I like that, you know, it doesn't get me to the point that alcohol did, but it gets close enough. You know, and so those people came back to me and they asked me to start drinking again. And the other thing that's important to me about that experience at 15 was that was the last time that I was able to stop. You know, I wasn't, those people didn't hang for long because, I mean, who's going to help me control it, you know? And then I'm just lying to them and, you know, cheating and stealing and doing the things that I needed to do to keep drinking and living the way that I wanted to live. And so, you know, they left my life shortly thereafter, and there was never anyone that could convince me that stopping was a good idea again. You know, like I'd try to moderate, I'd try to switch things around, I'd try to find a better way to control it, but that like stop altogether, nope, no thanks. And, you know, I started having increasing consequences. When I was 16, my parents had this surprise birthday party for me, and God love them. You know, I was a chameleon. I would go to different groups and I'm like, who do I need to be for you to like me? And so, you know, I played soccer and I was in like the honors program at school because of the A thing. And, you know, then I had like my friends that I was drinking with, and then I had the people at work and childhood friends and all that. And so my parents had this big party for me, and I went out the night before. So I was not in a really great state to be surprised the next morning. And they had invited people from all these groups. And I walked in and I remembered just the terror of like, I'm about to get caught. Not I'm about to get caught like drinking, but like there's all these people here and they are expecting different Katies. And I cannot be all of them at once. And so I got really angry because I'm like, anger is a universal emotion. I mean, I like had to storm out of there and like go to the junior high across the street and smoke a couple of cigarettes and like come back and like work myself. And like my grandparents had flown in from out of town to be there. And I was just awful, you know, because like I couldn't face all those people and have them know that, you know, I was just walking around living a lie every day. And so my solution was to go out again that night and, you know, I was supposed to come back and go to mass with my grandparents the next day who had flown all this way. And, you know, I don't know, 2 nights in a row, I'm not capable of being where I say I'm going to be. And I wasn't. And that started, you know, a series of consequences that over the next couple of years, just the hurdles got higher and closer together, and the steeplechase that I had to run to keep drinking. And for a long time, you know, I thought my only problem is that I have an alcoholic mom and my life would be okay if only she would stop drinking. You know, and the other thing, as I said, I had that first line of defense. And then if, you know, people started coming past that because I started to show my alcoholism a little bit more. I didn't know it then, but it was, you know, pretty obvious to the people around me that something was not okay. Then I had the things that, you know, my brother's illness, my mother's alcoholism, the stuff that happened to me when I was a kid. And I would pull that out. And I those were the cards in the back of my pocket, you know. And if you wanted to keep talking to me about my drinking, I would pull that stuff out. And I would say, unless or until these things have happened to you, don't talk to me about my drinking. How I choose to deal with my problems is my business and not yours. Thank you very much. You know, and some stuff started happening around then. When I was 14, that teacher finally got arrested and there was this big court case, and it was a lot, you know, it was a lot. But for me, it gave me this like glimmer of hope, because these two lawyers showed up in my life and did for the first time what no one before them had done. You know, I had lived in that space for 4 years, where I didn't feel like anybody believed me, or if they did believe me, they didn't care enough to do anything. You know, and that's a period of time that, if I'm honest about, I'm still struggling with, and I am still working on trying to let go of the ideas about myself and about other people and my relationships with other people that were born during that period. And I'm still working on that. And, you know, I had, as I said, my home had become violent when I started drinking, and actually before I started drinking. So I had dealt with police during that period. I mean, I had been very vocal, and these two lawyers showed up, and they gave me a voice where nobody else had before. And they inspired in me this desire to do that for other people. And, you know, so I had this dream, but I also had what I kept getting, you know, I kept getting like taken to people who shrink heads and stuff. And they kept telling me things like, you have a sense of a foreshortened future. 'Cause I couldn't picture life, you know, like I was just like, I'm gonna graduate high school and then I'll probably die, which, you know, the way that I was living, not far off. But I had this like glimmer of hope that there were these people who actually did things that mattered, and I wanted to be like that. And I couldn't live up to that, you know. And again, like, my fail stop for all of that was, I have an alcoholic mother, and my life would be okay if only she'd stop drinking. She did that when I was 16 years old. She went to detox. She did not go to treatment, so she was in detox for a few days and then started going to Alcoholics Anonymous. And she stopped drinking, you know. And I was not, this was not one of those like, I'm so impressed, gosh, that AA really works, I want that for myself. No. She stopped drinking and my life got more challenging. And she started getting in the way. And I don't care how much I love you. I don't care, you know, how much I want to be what you need me to be. If you come between me and alcohol before I found Alcoholics Anonymous, like, you are in the way and you need to move, or you're going to get run over. And I'm not going to feel bad about it, because you're the one who put yourself in the way. You know, like, I just really, really vicious person, and very, very jealous and protective of my drinking. And so I decided fairly quickly that my problem is now that I have a mother who is sober in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, my life would be okay if only she would start drinking again. And I made it my mission to get her to drink. You know, I was deliberately vicious and cruel. The things that I said in that period, I can't ever take that back, you know. And I don't, and to my mind, can't ever make amends for it. You know, I've got to show up every day and be a daughter to her, whether I feel like it or not, because, like, I lost the right to keep score a long time ago. And it didn't work. You know, she kept going to meetings and she kept not drinking. And I was like pissed. I really hated you guys. And so I started contemplating whether to spike her drink. And, you know, the way that I thought about it then was, I thought about it for a long time, and I ultimately decided not to, because I wanted to win. And I wanted to win fair and square. And to me, what that looked like was, I wanted her to choose to drink. And I knew at 16 years old that if I was able to get alcohol into her body, that she likely would continue drinking, but that it wouldn't be a choice. And the reason that I knew that was, at 16 years old, that was my experience every time I drank or did anything else like that. And I didn't want to win that way. You know, I wanted her to choose to drink. And so I didn't spike her drink, and she stayed sober. She's still sober. She got sober May 24th, 2002. So the last 11 months of my drinking are the first 11 months of her sobriety, and I would not wish that period on anyone. I don't care how much I don't like them. it was awful. And, you know, I just started having more and more consequences. You know, she did things like they went to the court and they got me designated an at-risk youth, which I was mortally offended by because I still had the grades and the job. Like, I'm not at risk of anything in my mind. And so that meant if I didn't follow, like, the house chores, like, I had to go to jail. And, well, I had to go to jail. Then I had to go to a judge and explain to him why I didn't do my laundry or come home on time. Or because I had figured out that you're grounded really didn't mean anything up until that point. So they found a way to make it mean something. You know, it was stuff like that. And, you know, what happened for me is as the consequences got more significant, this thing started. That wasn't going to be enough to get me sober. As long as alcohol was still working for me, you know, I'll sit in a jail cell. I had been there before. It's not as bad when you wake up the second time. Like, fine. You know, if that's a consequence of my drinking, as long as I could continue to drink and continue to get relief, it wasn't going to get my attention, and it didn't. But the last couple of months of my drinking, something started happening, you know, where I would drink and I would not feel better. And I started to not want to have to drink anymore. And I realized in that period that I couldn't stop or moderate. You know, I was without defense against alcohol. I was physically incapable of getting in my own way when it came to the drink. All, you know, I remember standing in front of my parents and all I had to do was ask them for help and they would have moved mountains because they were trying to do it against my will. And I remember wanting to ask them and what came out of my mouth was totally different. You know, and I had long since abandoned any idea of a higher power being able to help me, but I wrote a lot and I wrote poetry and I wrote in journals. And, you know, 5 days before I got sober, I wrote a poem and there was a line in it that says, "I cannot ask for help now. No one would hear my plea. They just accept those empty words that don't belong to me." You know, and I felt like a prisoner in my own body. And I kept drinking. You know, I had devised a scheme to like right the ship. I was a junior in high school and I was going to try out for cheerleading, which I had not been a joiner for a long time. And I was really going to try because the cheerleaders went away for the summer. And I was like, okay, so I'll go somewhere else and I won't get in trouble. And then I'll come back and I'll be like Miss Susie High School for senior year and everything will be okay. And the thing I didn't factor into was the head cheerleading coach had been my choir teacher in seventh grade. And I'd been like kicked out of the class for jumping someone on the bleachers in like the middle of choir practice. And this woman did not want me anywhere near her cheerleaders. So like I'm like a legend in my own mind, would have been the best cheerleader in the world. And I didn't make the team. And I had this asterisk on that like plan, which was if you don't make it, you can have the summer of a lifetime. No holds bar. We're not going to try anymore. Who cares? Consequences be damned. You know, like, I'm just going to do my own thing. And I didn't make the cheerleading squad in, like, February of 03. And I was like, it's like summer. You know, close enough. And I started drinking with abandon. You know, I would do things like take my parents' debit card to go down to the store and get them milk. And I would take $200 cash back for the inconvenience. You know, you don't do stuff like that for long without getting caught. And I quit going to school. I was a 4.0 student, but I was an absence away from getting kicked out of high school when I got sober. And, you know, I wrote that poem on April 9th, 2003. And to me, I think that was the closest thing I could come to a prayer. I couldn't ask my parents for help, and I certainly wasn't going to ask that thing that had never done anything for me for help. But I could recognize my inability to help myself, which was, I think, the thing that really was a change. Because up until that point, I always had a plan. You know, I got satisfaction out of the scheming and the planning and the plotting and the moving of the chess pieces almost as much as I did the drinking itself. And, you know, my best thinking got me a seat in Alcoholics Anonymous. I never brought my B game to planning and executing when it came to a drink, ever. And I think for me, I just was out of ideas. You know, I the places that I had to go and the people that I had to be with and the things that I had to do in order to keep drinking, they were bad. And they did not match the picture of myself that I had in my head. And it was, you know, I was really starting to see the truth about myself and I was losing the ability to blame other people for it at the same time. And alcohol wasn't taking the edge off of any of it. And, you know, and so on April 13th, I got caught in a stupid lie I hadn't really slept in a couple of weeks. And so when my parents confronted me about it, I hit my dad, and they didn't think that they needed to be treated that way. And so they called the police, and I got escorted out of my parents' home in my Lucky Charms pajama pants and handcuffs and taken down to the local station. I knew the police were coming. And so again, like, window into my brain and how it works at that point. This was April 13th, 2003. I hid my car. I had a little bit of something from the night before left over, which was also very unusual, and I hid that. And then I turned on my parents' computer, I deleted their taxes, and I uninstalled the tax program. And then I went to jail. you know, like, if you're gonna get me, I'll get you back. You know, careful who you mess with. And so I went to sleep. My parents did not find my car keys, but they found the other stuff. So I went to sleep with a misdemeanor, and I woke up with a felony charge, and I got carted off to juvenile detention. And I sat there for like 6 days, and then I went in front of the judge 6 days later in my orange jumpsuit, half a head of cornrows and leg shackles. And, you know, my ego, I'm tough. Like, I have totally recovered from whatever shame or humiliation I had been feeling a week earlier. You know, I love more about alcoholism when it talks about those curious mental blank spots and our inability to bring in our minds with sufficient force the humiliation or the suffering of a week or a month ago. Like, I was fully committed to who I was, and what I was doing when I walked in front of that judge. No one was going to tell me that I needed to be different, even though 6 days earlier I was dying inside myself for something to change. And, you know, I stood up in front of that judge, and he granted me a bond. I didn't really know what happened because I'm not fully there. You know, there was a lot of detoxing that went on in that jail cell. But my parents, I do know my parents told them, we don't want her. And they refused to pay the bond. And they sent me back up there to think about that for another 3 weeks. I did ultimately get out after they had a place to take me. And that was a lockdown juvenile treatment center about an hour and a half away, where I spent the next 4 months. And, you know, when I got there, they took our shoes. They gave me a pair of gray sweats, and, like, we had to earn the right to use the phone. We had to earn the right to go outside. We had to earn the right to go to AA meetings. We had to earn our shoes. I mean, it was like 2 or 3 months before you were given shoes again. We, like, lived in slippers, bars on the window. Not for the faint of heart. You know, and I'm really grateful that I went to that place, because I was incapable of seeing any kind of a life that was different. You know, my mom, one of the conditions that I had from that judge before I got sober was I had to go to AA meetings with my mom. And I, like, so out of it, could not hear anything that anybody was saying. I went to one at a treatment center. It was like 70 women, an hour and a half meeting. 5 minutes before the end of the meeting, I stood up and I was like, my name's Katie and I'm not done yet. And I proceeded to tell the whole room how sorry I felt for them. They had messed up their drinking so bad. They couldn't cut it out there anymore. But I don't need this. I don't need to be here. I got it. I'm fine. Thanks for letting me share. You know, like, I wasn't going to get, you know, I'm dying in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I couldn't take the hand that was being freely extended to me. And so I'm grateful for having been in that place, because it gave me enough time away from my life that, you know, what happened for me in that period is that I was more afraid of continuing to be what I had become, continuing to live that life, than anything else. I didn't care. Whatever it was, as long as I didn't have to drink again, like, when I got out, I was willing to do something different, you know. And that's the thing that changed for me. And I had gone to some meetings in between being in jail and going to treatment. And I remember this woman there, she had 3 months sober, and she talked about her obsession with grades. And she talked about having to get a 4.0. And it was the first time I'd heard someone in a meeting share something about me, you know. And I was like, will you be my sponsor? And she's like, I can't sponsor you. I got like 3 months. But, you know, that woman wrote me letters when I was in treatment. And I don't know what happened to her, but she planted that seed of Alcoholics Anonymous for me, that there might be something here that would help me when I got out, you know. And that made me willing to listen to the people who brought meetings into that treatment center. It made me willing to listen to the people in the meetings that we went to from that treatment center. You know, and I got out and I was like, I'm going to be perfect. I already told you, I went to all the A's. I was like, I'm gonna get the perfect sponsor, and I'm gonna work the perfect steps, and I'm gonna check all the boxes. I'm just gonna be perfect. I'm gonna be the best AA there ever was. 90 meetings in 90 days, which So they told me to get a sponsor who had what you wanted. So I found a woman with short, spiky blonde hair who said the F word in meetings and rode a motorcycle and wore a leather jacket. And I was like, I want to be like that. And she just wanted me to call her every day, which worked really well until she stopped answering her phone. And then I didn't have any other spiritual solution. You know, I'm like, I'm going to drink. But I got in a home group because they said you need one of those. And I really believe that when we get sober, there's this grace that we're given. You know, when we're finally willing to raise our hand and say, I cannot do this. Something happened. At least it happened for me, and I've seen it happen for a lot of other people, where we're able to not drink one day at a time long enough to get a sponsor, read the book, work the steps, and get that spiritual solution, you know, that spiritual awakening that's promised as the result of the steps in step 12. For some reason, I was able to not drink where I had not been able to do that before long enough for that to happen. You know, and for me, that's how I used that time. And I can see that grace working, because when I lost that first sponsor, a guy in my home group, he was like 7 feet tall. You know, I remember like looking up at him like this, and he's like, I want you to go ask Judy to be your sponsor. And I just said, okay. And I'm not an okay, like, I don't agree to stuff without question, ever. I am a lawyer now, so, you know, like, that's just my nature. And I said, okay. You know, and the woman he directed me to was someone who had a big book study in her house once a week. She met with the women upstairs. Her husband met with the men downstairs. We read the book line by line. We looked up words I didn't understand. We talked about the steps, you know, and I needed that. Like, there's like, if you count the preface and the forewords and the doctor's opinion and all the stuff before we agnostics, there's like 75 pages of stuff about AA and really the first step. And I needed every single one of those to become convinced that I was an alcoholic, because I was willing to admit long before I got sober that I had a problem with the other stuff. I liked the word addict. I thought it was like, it brought on this like Hollywood noir, like, yeah, takes a certain kind of person, you know? And I fancied myself that kind of person, and I liked that, and it fed my ego. Do not call me an alcoholic, you know? And so that was a big hurdle for me to admit that, and because I didn't understand what it was. I thought I knew what alcoholism was because I had a front row seat to it. I didn't understand that it was a physical, mental, and spiritual relationship with alcohol. And that the physical piece was that I had an allergy, that when I put alcohol in my body, something happened to me that doesn't happen to non-alcoholics. And that I keep drinking even when I don't want to. And I don't have control over what happens next. You know, and I was able to learn that doing things like reading Bill's story with my sponsor and talking about how Bill drank. And then, well, how did you drink? And, you know, like, I couldn't, reading, you know, there is a solution, and more about alcoholism and the way that the alcoholics thought, you know, did you think like that? You know, there's a part, I think, in, I've got not the book that we read there, but in one of the forewords where, actually, the preface, we turned the end of the preface into questions. Did that happen to me? Have I felt like that? Do I believe this program can work for me too? You know, we talked about that stuff. So I learned about the physical allergy, which, you know, without a sponsor, the doctor's opinion was not in English. Like, I really needed help to understand what that chapter said. We talked about the mental obsession, that when I'm not drinking, alcohol is all I think about. Alcohol is the thing that's guiding my thoughts, words, and actions, my decisions. I'm always moving the chess pieces in a way that I think will enable me to get to the next drink. And for me, the spiritual relationship with alcohol was the spiritual void that ripped open inside of me as I kind of bounced back and forth between caught in the physical allergy, caught in the mental obsession, caught in the physical allergy, caught in the mental obsession, that like I just destroyed my soul. You know, it felt like I was falling into this abyss, and it was never going to stop, and it was swallowing me whole. And everything that I thought about myself and who I wanted to be, I just, you know, I couldn't live up to that. Alcohol was my master in all things. And I'm so grateful that that was my experience with the first step, that it took a while, and that I had a sponsor to guide me through all of that and to answer my questions, because I did struggle. You know, I got sober at 17. When I went to college, when I turned 21, when I started seeing people get married, you know, I struggled with, like, am I an alcoholic or was I just a really crazy teenager? You know, and I learned through that process, and I have become convinced that my spiritual, mental, and physical relationship to alcohol will always be the same. it's like a game of poker. You know, I had different chips back then. They were, I didn't have as many of them, and they were lots like lower in value. I got a lot of chips today as a result of being a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And there are a lot of them, and they're a lot higher value, and I don't want to trade them in. But if I play the game, I play the game, you know? I cash in my chips, and I lose every time. And like I said, I don't get to pick my consequences. I don't get to hoard the stash of chips that really matter to me and give you the stuff that I think I can live without. Like, it just happens, you know? And I'm so grateful for that, because I know to my core that I'm an alcoholic today, and I know what that means. And I did not want a higher power to be the answer to this. And I didn't know how to get access to a higher power. You know, everything that I've let go of, including alcohol, has had claw marks in it or been like shredded to bits beyond recognition. And, you know, when it talks about and how it works, you know, we had to let go of our old ideas. The result was nil until we let go absolutely and all that. I'm like, well into sobriety, I have struggled with that. When I've been faced with an old idea and people are like, let go, I'm like, how? How do you let go? Like, dating was a big thing for me. I got married last year, which I'm super happy about, but that worked out in spite of me, not because of anything I did. And I mean, there was like 10 years in sobriety when I was like trying to date and not having it work, and people would be like, when you stop looking? And I would be like, how do you stop looking? If you would just tell me how, I would gladly do it. I was in a meeting literally yesterday morning when we were reading How It Works, and I was like, result was nil until we let go absolutely. Half measures availed of us nothing. Here are the steps we took. How do you let go? You work the steps, you know? Like, and I mean, I have done that over and over again, but like, I don't see that kind of stuff. I was telling my sponsor this on the way up here, and she's like, this is why you need to keep going to meetings. You know, like, I finally see the things that people have been telling me for years, you know? And I was really reluctant to work the steps. I thought, a lot of us go through this where we think we have to figure God out before we can work the steps. And I say God, I still don't have a God with a capital G, but I like the word. So, you know, use it as you will. And I was like wrangling over that. And my sponsor told me, you know, just believe that I believe. If you don't have a God, why don't you borrow mine and let's keep going? You know, and that's the best I could do on step two, you know. I could believe in Alcoholics Anonymous because this was the first place I had ever been where people talked about where I was as if they had been there in ways that only someone who had been there would be able to articulate. And I could look at them and I could see that they were not there anymore. And so I knew there was a way out of this, and I could believe in that. And so when she said, borrow my God, I was like, okay. And then, you know, when we got to step three, it was about, I'm like, oh God, turn it over. Like, you know, we said the prayer in the big book study. We all did that, and I didn't feel anything. And she's like, step three is a decision to do the rest of the steps. Like, if you're going to turn your will and your life over to the care of a higher power, you certainly don't have any idea how to do that. And we've got steps that'll show you the way. And she's like, so if you want to know whether you've taken your third step, are you writing your fourth step? And the fourth step was hard for me because I'm a perfectionist. So like, I got a ruler for my columns, and I, you know, I'm like, I'm gonna do it perfect. And I mean, it took me almost a year to get it done because I was so afraid of leaving. I mean, it was back to that like list with God, right? Like, I'm so afraid of leaving something off, and it's gonna get me drunk. And I got in a relationship while I was doing that, which I don't recommend, but it helped me because when he ended up on the list, my sponsor's like, you didn't know him when we started this, so you might be in maintenance territory and we could probably go ahead with five now, you know? And I didn't feel great after five. My first fifth step, like, you know, I came in here a victim. It was everybody's fault but mine. And as long as I could blame you, I'm not taking responsibility for the consequences of my actions and my decisions. No. And I had written down a lot. I mean, I had two notebooks. It took 2 days to go through it. And I saw some truths about myself that I didn't want to see. And, you know, there was stuff like that stuff with the teacher that happened where, you know, at the time, there really wasn't anything that I had done. But I had taken that experience and used it as an excuse to hurt other people for a really long time, you know. And so even the stuff where I hadn't made a mistake in the moment, I could see where I had been selfish, where I had been dishonest, and I had been self-seeking and afraid. And I didn't want to live that way. And I didn't really get 6 and 7 the first time that I did it. I thought, like, the way I read the steps is, like, 4 and 5 are really hard. 8 and 9 are really hard. 6 and 7 is where we, like, rest a minute, you know, gather ourselves back up and then get at it again, making another list, you know. I was 3 years sober before I found out that 6 and 7 are about changing behavior, you know, about learning how to live different. And that the key to that is the same key to the whole rest of this, is that I lack the power to do that. If I could have been different, I would have been different. I always wanted to be a good daughter and a good sister and a good friend and a good girlfriend, good employee. I just couldn't do it because if it was ever an inconvenience to me, I always put me first. I just don't know how to be different, you know? And it was that process of turning that over, of, you know, letting go of my own objectives for that better and bigger objective, which is of my higher power, you know? And it's hard because it talks about in the 12 and 12, letting go of short-sighted and unworthy desires, which when I want something, it never feels short-sighted and it never feels unworthy. It is very important that I have what I want. You know, but I had to learn, and I've had to learn the hard way in many, many different areas since then, that, like, I don't know what's good for me. I have never called the good shots, ever, ever. Like I'm 0 for, like, a million now. You know, if I had gotten what I wanted, I would have sold myself short over and over and over and over again. That example of the sponsor, you know, the sponsor that I picked, the sponsor who saved my life, you know. The guy that I wanted to marry 5 years ago and the guy that I'm married to today, like, same story. You know, I pick what I think is going to be good for me. And God's like, don't sell yourself short, you know. And for me, when I run the show, it just gets more and more painful. You know, every time I try at it in control, like, the bottom falls out and I'm in more pain and I'm in more pain until I finally say uncle. You know, and I'm so grateful that I haven't had to drink again. But I think the thing that has helped me with that is that when those things happen to me, I see my alcoholism working without the drink. You know, when I go through those rash of self-wills and I deal with those consequences, I, you know, it looks the same. It's just in different clothing. And I can see that because I have a sponsor who I'm honest with, because I have women who I'm accountable to. 8 and 9. I, you know, you all raised me. That's, I mean, I became an adult walking through 8 and 9 with a sponsor. You know, I learned how to pay bills, making financial amends. I had a lot of financial amends to pay and I had no money. So I had to write, like, $20 checks every 2 weeks. And I learned how to pay bills by making financial amends in Alcoholics Anonymous. Most people, when I asked them what I could do to make it right, told me to keep doing what I was doing. And for me, what that means is that my membership in Alcoholics Anonymous is no longer just about me. You know, I made a commitment to those people that I would continue to come here and I would continue to do this and I would continue to stay sober as amends for the way that I had treated them. And in doing that, I get to mend what I broke, but I get to amend my behavior. I learned slowly through prayer. I'm always on the slow bus, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. I'm always on the slow bus. I learned, you know, how to show up for other people. And I do that today through 12 and trying to work with other women, trying to practice these principles in all my affairs. And I just want to say a couple of things about step 11 and then I'll sit down, because I was 9 years sober before I could even attempt step 11, because I thought when you all talked about a conscious contact with a higher power, you all had the capital G God after, like, 2 years sober. And because I didn't, I couldn't do step 11. I would want to crawl out of step 11 meetings on my stomach. I just, not good enough. That, you know, that yardstick, I held on to that one for so long. And it wasn't until I met an atheist at 9 years sober and talked to her about how she practiced an 11th step and what she wrote out and how she tried to apply principles to her life that I became willing to set aside what I thought I had to have and just try to start where I was at. And that's when I started to see things like in the 12 and 12, where it says it's essentially an individual adventure. And that really opened the door for me. And I, you know, in the last couple of months, have really committed to an 11th step. I love Don M. He was just in Richmond and he was sharing. He talked about, I call it a 10 by 10, where he does, like, 10 things he's grateful for in the morning, draws a line down the page, and then 10 things that if he does them, he will be more comfortable that day. And if he doesn't do them, he will be less comfortable. And I have to put things like be on time to the meeting, answer your phone. It's not the kind of list that I make where I'm like, finish this project, you know? And as I have done that, I have been able to let go of the morbid reflection for the mistakes that I've made, which I use, it's just another form of self-obsession, the way I think about me. I'm not beating myself up where I fall short. I'm able to look at that list at the end of the day, see where I fell short, ask myself honestly what I could do better, and it gives me something to go by the next day. And I'm not great. You know, I put something on my list on Monday, and it was Friday before I even attempted it. And it had to be on the list every single day, but I'm not beating myself up. I have a level of self-acceptance and peace about my own process, and trusting that, like, I don't get to decide when I get these things. I don't get to decide what my growth looks like. But as long as I'm willing to sit down, spend that time, connect to a higher power, show up here, and put this first, everything else is going to be okay, you know? And it has been, you know, the stuff that I thought AA couldn't fix, I've gotten relief from. The stuff that I'm still working on, I have the ability to walk through it without a drink, which is the one thing I asked of my higher power when I got here, was to not to have to drink anymore. And I haven't had to since April 14th, 2003. And for that, I'm eternally grateful. Thanks for my sobriety.